Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All right, so with the release of this, these police videos with respect to the police-involved shooting of Derek Reed in Garfield Park last month, where this 26-year-old Derek Reed was killed. One of the officers on scene was shot and is recovering. So you had a tactical team, five officers, and multiple angles on all this from their body cams, all which was released. If you want to see the videos that we're about to describe, and you're about to hear portions of, CWB Chicago, I think, has the best rundown of the various videos that were released that show a lot of different angles to this scene on their Twitter account or X account. So here's what happened, like 90 seconds. 90 seconds when this tactical team rolls up on Reed for allegedly not wearing his seatbelt, traffic stop. And, well, this is how that goes.
Roll the windows down.
Put the window down, man.
Roll the window down. What are you doing?
Roll this one down.
Roll that one down, too. Hey, don't roll the window up. The window up.
Okay.
Do not roll the window up.
Hey, do not
roll unlock the doors
up.
Now.
The door.
Unlock the doors
open
now.
The
door. Unlock the doors
door
now. Open the door now. Open the door now. Open the door now.
So there's your 96 shots that have been so widely reported, and two shots that have been less widely reported. The two shots, the first shot that was fired, which was from Derek Reed inside the car, and another shot that I believe was fired by him when he got out of the car on the passenger side, which you see from another angle of one of the officer's body cam.
And the officer was shot in the forearm that was hit. But 96 shots, most they say were fired by a 23-year-old rookie officer. But
irrelevant.
I don't.
The deal here, too, if you haven't seen it, is you have to understand the way that it's being reported makes it sound like five cops were standing around this car and just opening fire, when, of course, that wasn't the case. As soon as he fired the first shot, what did they do? Naturally, they retreated to positions of safety. You see this happening. And then they fire on the car because he initiated the firefight. And then why do they keep firing, Dan? Why 96 shots? Here we go again. 16 shots, 96 shots, as if the number of shots is what's relevant. They keep firing because they don't know if the subject has been subdued, number one. And then, as I said, when you see a different angle When you see one of the angles, I should say, from the car, you see that he is outside of the car and coming around where you hear that female officer you just heard say, hands up, hands up. And he's coming around the car and he's shot outside the car. So he was, after that first wave of gunfire, he was clearly still alive because he was able to get out of the passenger side and come around the car on that side. And he was still armed and he still was noncompliant.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also text us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I mean, he was already facing illegal gun charges at the time. So if he would, you know, if he was arrested, taken into custody, he would have gone back to jail.
But possibly. We never know in this system in Cook County. Yeah. But here's the thing. So you have to look at this through the lens of all of the institutional interests in the political system, the rigged political system as it's currently set up. That's the only way to understand this, because it's the only way to process why this is being considered and reported as a controversial shooting, because it's not. Not in my view.
It's not at all. The Chicago police did textbook work here. They did a good job. They asked him to come out. He ignored their orders, and the cops did what they had to do to de-escalate the situation.
So we need to think about this, though, through the institutions. So the political ruling class, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, the fifth floor. Think about this. All the stakeholders who benefit from this identitarian political spoil system that is Chicago. So the politicians, the trial lawyers, the media. Otherwise, it's very difficult, in my view, to get clarity. And it's if you don't understand the motivations and who it benefits, then you don't understand the nature of how Chicago processes something like this police-involved shooting. So here's the politicians. Kim Fox. She's still the Cook County State's Attorney, don't you know?
If the evidence proves beyond a reasonable doubt that the force used was illegal, our office will file criminal charges.
See, you got to go right to saying, you know, we're looking to hold these police officers accountable.
Right. And Mayor Johnson even said that he will not condone police shootings. Really?
Right. You have to sort of insinuate and, you know, not very couched terms, that the police are the ones undeserving of the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
That the police are the suspects in this case. And paper over the individual we're talking about, Derek Reed, and his behavior on that fateful day. That all has to be papered over because you have an identitarian political constituency to serve, one that you've created.
Yeah.
So here's
defunding Brandon, the police.
Well, here's the interesting thing about Brandon Johnson's response, in part, it was actually a little bit more sophisticated than I thought.
Really?
He's becoming a little bit more of a politician than you might think. Take a listen. Now, I know, you know, he quickly moved past this and then got to standing with COPA and standing with Kim Fox and making all sorts of thinly veiled insinuations in the direction of police. But take a look at how he started, or take a listen to how he started his remarks.
My heart breaks for the family of Dexter Reed. They are grieving the loss of a son, a brother, and a nephew. I spoke to Dexter's family this weekend and offer them my deepest condolences. I know there is also a community of friends, teammates, coaches, and neighbors who are all mourning his loss as well. I've also been praying for the full recovery of the officer who was shot during this interaction and who I visited in the hospital the day of the incident. And thankfully, he's recovering. But if that bullet had hit him a few inches in a different direction, I would be here today talking about the loss of another black man. It weighs heavily on me that this event took place just blocks away from my own community. And it is not lost on me that both Dexter Reed and this officer could have been my students. As a city, I want our efforts to be focused on accountability and transparency. And that is why today I'm joined by leadership from the Civilian Office of Police Accountability and the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. All of us up here are making a firm commitment to collaboration, to cooperation, and to provide transparency for the people of Chicago so that we can ensure that accountability is upheld and justice is achieved.
A lot of boxes checked there. The black cop who was shot. Oh, it's a black cop.
Well, how convenient.
Well, and then, you know, then you have to do the whole, you know, Trayvon Martin could have been my son.
Right. They could have been my students instead of my son. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You taught for 5 seconds. Stop.
But the consideration for police, didn't expect that from Brandon Johnson. Checking some boxes there. Growing up a little bit politically. We'll see what John Cantanzara thinks about that statement when we talk to him at the bottom of next hour. But
yeah.
Brenna in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Why are police expendable?
Why are police expendable?
It seems that you can take pot shots at police or shoot them, and when they shoot back, that you turn around and, you know, the police are in the wrong because they're defending themselves.
Right.
I understand how you feel. I mean,
thanks for the call, Brenna.
Michael Brown, George Floyd, every police shooting, if they just would have complied, if they just would have rolled down the car window, if they just would have gotten out of the vehicle, if they just would have not had a full-blown panic attack and made things worse, they brought it upon themselves. Please stop. And Reed's family, my God, they're trying to make this into a Michael Brown or a George Floyd.
I just missed my son. I'm hurt.
Oh, what?
I'm sick.
Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, so politically incorrect trigger warning coming up. So Derek Reed started the firefight, so game on. 96 rounds expended at current ammo prices is still cheaper than all the money that would have been wasted keeping him alive in jail even one night. So that's my thoughts.
Yeah. And it's not like 96
Thanks
shots
for the call,
were
Ralph.
Pumped into his body. That's what people are not missing, too.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You're talking about the police-involved shooting of Dexter Reed last month with the police body cam videos being released yesterday. I thought it was interesting. My Scott was reporting this all day yesterday morning. Larry Snelling, the CPD superintendent, saying this video is going to be released. We trust the residents of Chicago to view it and process it on their own and draw their own conclusions and so on and so forth. Oh, Superintendent Snelling, aren't you cute?
Well, they didn't want 2020 redux, and only one person was arrested yesterday outside the 11th police district.
Yeah, but the point is, I mean, I wasn't expecting rioting over it, particularly after I saw it, but that's not how things are processed in Chicago. I can't emphasize this enough. The only way to understand Chicago's reaction is to process it through the institutions and the heads of those institutions who benefit from the racial, the rigged racial spoil system in Chicago. Cui bono? Who benefits? Identitarian politicians? Trial lawyers? Media? And black residents who have given up their agency. And if you don't treat them as groups and understand the motivations and the landscape on which they operate, the philosophy they have chosen to adopt, then you can't understand why somebody pulled over in a traffic stop who opens fire on police and police return fire and ultimately kill him, why this is in controversy. Why this is something we're supposed to brace for, why this is something that we need to pore over and we need to, you know, look at it from the angle of the family members and their trial lawyer representatives and so on and so forth. But we were forced to do these things in order to make sure that we stay with both feet planted firmly on the ground, as opposed to being whisked away to this imaginary world that the race hustlers want to take us. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. We mentioned the politicians. You've heard from Kim Fox. You've heard from Brandon Johnson. ABC7. ABC7 reporting by Chuck Gowdy and the I-Team. From the stop to the shots.
Roll that one down, too. Hey, don't roll the window up. Don't roll the window up.
The tactical unit said that Dexter Reed was curbed in this SUV because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, an incident that prompted Reed to open fire on police. The 26-year-old was already facing illegal gun charges at the time he was pulled over. Had police found the gun in his car, Reed might well have returned to jail. Instead, authorities say he opened fire and they returned 96 shots, at least 50 fired by a 23-year-old rookie officer.
The number of shots matter. The number of shots fired by a particular individual matters. The number of years on the force by that particular officer matters. Why? Was it a good shoot or not? Was it a proportional response to the threat? Was it reasonable or not?
I just think as a reporter, they're just releasing some details that they got from COPA. I don't see this as him trying to... Just because I used to be out there, I don't see this him as Chuck trying to persuade anybody to make police look bad.
Really? I'm so glad you said that, because I'll look forward to seeing if your opinion changes when the 96 shots documentary comes out. As the chants were happening with the trial lawyers and the family members. 96 shots, you murdered my son, so on and so forth. 96 shots. You don't think you're going to hear that again? See it on a T-shirt? Oh, and your Chuck Gowdy? No, he's not. He's just giving details. He's just providing the full story, because that's what all of these dutiful reporters from the network affiliates in Chicago do. Really?
Traffic stop trouble in Chicago isn't new. In 2020, the I-Team first revealed an analysis of police records determining that of more than 2 million traffic stops by Chicago police since 2016, 60% were black drivers, even though black residents make up 27% of the city's population.
Was that just giving data to? Is that the full story?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. The first part, I don't have a problem with that. I don't know why he threw that in there.
You don't. You have no idea.
I-Team.
You have no idea why he would throw that in there.
No, wait, because he has a political motive, obviously.
Right, but the first part didn't. He slipped that in at the end because he made a boo-boo. Or he didn't. I don't know. Which is it? But I do know that it's fascinating to talk about traffic stops. And it's fascinating to just look at traffic stops or categories of crime and say, you know, X percent of the total number of people arrested for this are black, even though they represent X percentage of the population. But you never hear that other piece of it, that X percent of the population is black, and yet black men mainly account for 80% of the violent crime in Chicago, also represent 80% of the victims. What? He didn't have time to get that in, or is that what you think? Because the Chicago press corps does not have blood on their hands with respect to demonizing police. They covered it right down the middle during the summer of love in 2020, during the summer of joy that Lori Lightfoot designated in 2022. They always cover it right down the middle with police in general and certainly police involved shootings, right? So we're certainly supposed to give Chuck Audi and the I-Team and all the other network affiliate reporters the benefit of the doubt because they are fair-minded. They're just scriveners of what is occurring on the streets and do not, you know, look with a jaundiced eye at anything they may insert or leave out. Right. Sure. Okay. Steve, Northwest Side.
I told my wife yesterday that when this story, before the story broke, I said, these cops are going to come out on the bad end of the story no matter what. And I was right. They're going to dirty these guys up no matter how righteous this shooting was. I am absolutely incensed by the way the city and the news media, and particularly Chuck Gowdy, treat the police in the city. You wonder why people aren't joining the police department? Well, here's a classic example. They send these young guys out, guys and gals, tell them, go make the community a safer community where you work. Try to get guns off the street. Try to get the dope problem under control. And when this something like this happens, when they get shot at, this guy shot at them. Think about that for a minute. He shot at them 8 times, and they returned fire. They defended their own lives, and they're getting the short end of the stick here. I am just incensed. I wanted to go back on that job so bad. I tried to get back on the job twice after I retired. Thank God they wouldn't take me back because once you go, you're gone. You know, you're just another, you're a nobody now. I just can't begin to tell you how upset I am about this. God bless these coppers. I know what's going to happen here, and it's not going to be good for them. I'm quite certain of that. They're going to try to make an example out of them. They're going to dirty them up, and they're going to be coming out as the bad guys in this whole story. And that is just wrong, man.
Thanks for the call, Steve. All I can say is 96 shots. The family and their legal representation, which is substantial, and they should be fired. They should be prosecuted. They committed murder.
COPA wants the 5 officers stripped of their police powers.
Correct. They're on a 30-day administrative leave right now.
Which is wrong.
So, institutions. So, Chuck Gowdy did a wonderful job of representing the Chicago Press Corps. The trial lawyers. The trial lawyers that fund the politicians. The trial lawyers that are profiled the media as the heroes. Standing up for the little guy. All these civil rights attorneys roaming around. Right. Sure they are. Yeah. I can't wait to hear their arguments before the high court on matters of constitutional law. Talk about street hustlers, race hustlers, whatever kind of hustler they need to be. Oh, right. They're riding in. The cavalry is here. The trial lawyers like Stephen Hart. Some bottom feeding honky trying to enrich himself on the backs of a black community that has given up its agency, like this family. I'm sorry. Is that not true? Encomiums I heard about Dexter Reed. He was a coach. He was this. He was that. He was a son. He was a nephew. Mm-hmm. Where'd he work? He's 26 years old. He was at home with mom. At least that's what mom said.
Did he have a job?
Well, he was arrested for retail theft. He was arrested for illegal gun possession.
Yeah.
And it was just a traffic stop.
Why are they even a gazillion times for not wearing my seatbelt?
Why are they even doing that?
Why?
Why even bother? Right, I know. That's
people
the whole
do that
thing.
All the, right.
We're supposed to eliminate traffic stops. There's actually legislation in Springfield for Justin Slaughter, the author of the Safety Act, the Pritzker Purge Law, to do just that. A traffic stop that pulled over somebody who thought it was a good idea to open fire on police officers. Are you happy or sad that they pulled that person over? That they I'm not saying I wanted him to die, but that they got him off the street. They pulled him over for a reason. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. This was a tactical unit in a particular neighborhood. These tactical officers, these gang units, they know who's who.
Are. Oh, of course they know.
Right. So, and I'm not saying they know who's who, like the lawyer's lingo that you're about to hear, pretextual and this and that. They know not he's black. They know who he specifically is. They know who specific people are and their specific connections to specific illicit activity. So if a honky like me can get pulled over for not wearing my seatbelt, which I have many times.
Right, me too. We're white.
Then nobody else should be exempt either, right? If you don't like the seatbelt law, go to Springfield and talk to your legislators and have them change it. Clay in Libertyville.
I despise the seatbelt law, but that's from my own personal belief.
Me too.
Thank you. Danny did beat me to the punch. Yes, they ignore a giant statistic there. 80% of the crime is committed by African-American people in Chicago. Perfect. Nail on the head. A couple good tips and tricks for not being shot at 96 times when you get pulled over for a seatbelt. Comply with lawful orders. Roll the window down. Roll the back window down.
Yep.
Don't have an illegal gun in the car. I mean, is this common sense? I guess not.
Thanks for the call,
Just
Clay.
Just do what they say. It's so simple.
Listen. I mean, you think the politicians are bad.
All right, let me hear this.
You got to listen to the trial lawyers.
Oh, Stephen Hart?
Stephen Hart.
It cannot be lost on the public that the Reed family lost their beloved son, brother, nephew. He was precious to them. And what's worse is that he lost his life at the hands of those that took an oath to serve and protect him. The explanation that we're getting today is that Dexter was pulled over for failing to wear his seatbelt. Now, this leaves many, many questions. Why were tactical officers jumping out of an unmarked police car with their guns drawn for a simple traffic violation of not wearing your seatbelt? Dexter did not run. There was no chase.
Oh, no, not at all.
They asked him to roll down his window. He did. And in response, he got guns in his face.
He didn't run. There was no chase. He just opened fire.
Right, exactly. Get your facts straight.
Sheila Beattie. Sheila Beattie from the Pritzker School of Law at Northwestern University. Wait till you get a load of this broad.
All right, I want to hear this.
Chicago Police Department TAC teams are out on the hunt. That is precisely what happened to Dexter Reed.
Dexter Reed was the Chicago Tactical Unit, Chicago Police's prey.
You want to hear another point of contention for them? How did they know he didn't have a seatbelt on? Because he had tinted windows.
Next, let's talk about de-escalation. Every single thing, every single police officer did in this encounter escalated it over and over. From coming out of the car with their guns out, to screaming commands, to brandishing their weapons inside the window, escalating over and over and over. Then, of course, there's the use of force, which lacked proportionality. None of those officers saw Dexter Reed as a beloved community member, son, nephew. They saw him as prey.
Oh, my God. Like they're out there hunting people down? Stop it.
That wasn't a tactical unit. That was a death squad. That's what Northwestern clinical law professor Sheila Beattie has to say. Talk about. Let's have a conversation about proportional and responsible and accountable. Mm-hmm. Former Chicago Police Brian Warner, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. Unfortunately, there's we perfected a playbook in Chicago. Like you said, round up the troops. We have an officer-involved shooting. Let's make the police look bad. Get the liberal people at the DePaul University and the professors that know crime, that wouldn't know a gun if they had one put in their face. Get the ministers from the community to say how wonderful the boy was. Most importantly, get the shyster attorneys. They're going to benefit from this tragedy. And get the family all dressed up, and let's have a press conference. Brandon Johnson is so, yeah, he checked a few boxes. But one thing that he missed, and I hope so many other people saw that from the body cameras yesterday, the trauma the officers experienced because of that kid's poor decision.
Yeah.
How they were walking around when the officer was laying on the ground when they realized he was shot. Brandon didn't mention that. He mentioned the family of the offender. He mentioned the community. Those officers, every single officer that responded there yesterday, and all the officers throughout the country that have to see that video, they take that personally and they carry that with them. So let's look at that factor, please.
Thanks for the call, Brian.
Thank you.
Yeah. The family. Here's a sister.
Regardless of the person that they try to portray Dexter as, he was not one of those. Why does the police keep doing this to a young black African man? If he was supposed to be pulled over for a traffic stop, why did they have four guns pointed at him? He was scared.
So if you're afraid, then it's okay to open fire on police. I mean, there's just no getting around. You can talk all day long, and you can hire all the plaintiff's attorneys you want. There's just no getting around opening fire on police. I don't know who Dexter Reed was or what he did and didn't do, but I know what he did on that day. We all do. And he dug his own grave. That's what happened.
Hear about the big stories of the day. Then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The MacArthur Foundation is sad today.
No,
they're sad. Since 82, the MacArthur Foundation, which is a great illustration of Robert Conquest's second law of politics, which is to say that an organization that is not explicitly conservative will drift left over time. MacArthur Foundation is a funder of all things new Marxist, like the NPR Times. Since 82, MacArthur Foundation has given $6 million to Chicago Public Media. Also contributed $10 million toward that illustrious merger 2 years ago between the then AFL-CIO Times, which became the NPR Times.
Yeah.
And they cut a third of their staff the other day, as we mentioned, even with we, the taxpayers, being forced to underwrite the NPR Times.
And they only have an hour of local programming now.
Yeah.
You imagine? Wow.
They still can't make a go of it, even being insulated from the vagaries of market economics. As longtime supporters of journalism and media, that's not journalism, and a now leading funder in revitalizing local news, no, you're not. We at MacArthur are saddened to hear about the cuts at Chicago Public Media and the elimination of Vocalo's broadcast signal. Oh, yeah, their Vocalo radio station, which had R&B, jazz, and Spanish language programming, that got shuttered, too. Well, sorry you wasted all that money on the NPR Times and WBEZ's Drek. And that's not me saying Drek. That's Uri Berliner, that is, who spent 25 years at NPR. I mean, he wouldn't probably use exactly the term Drek, but a revealing interview he gave and to Barry Weiss, an op-ed he wrote over at her outfit, the Free Press, about how NPR's lost America's trust. Really good, actually. And, you know, this is somebody that, even though we're diametrically opposed politically, I suspect you could have a conversation with. If Barry Weiss could, I could. You know the stereotype of the NPR listener, he writes, an EV driving, Wordle playing, tote bag carrying coastal elite. It doesn't precisely describe me, but it's not far off. I'm Sarah Lawrence educated, was raised by a lesbian peace activist mother. I drive a Subaru, and Spotify says my listening habits are most similar to people in Berkeley. That's a real admission.
Awesome.
Okay. Well, hey, I appreciate full disclosure. All right, Uri, I'm listening. So when I got a job here 25 years ago, I never looked back. As a senior editor on the business desk where news is always breaking, we've covered upheavals in the workplace, supermarket prices, social media, and AI. It's true NPR has always had a liberal bent, but most of my tenure here, we were open-minded. A curious culture prevailed. We were nerdy, but not knee-jerk activists or scolding. In recent years, however, that's changed. Today, those who listen to NPR or read its coverage online find something different. The distilled worldview of a very small segment of the U.S. population. If you're a conservative, you'll read this and say, duh, it's always been like this, but it hasn't. For decades, since its founding in 1970, a wide swath of America tuned into NPR for reliable journalism and gorgeous audio pieces with birds singing in the Amazon. Okay, that's fair. It's not that long ago, and I mean, he has some data to back up his claim.
We have a Cadillac, what we call a Cadillac plan.
Okay. I don't know.
Back in 2011, he writes, although NPR's audience tilted a bit to the left, it still bore resemblance to America at large. 26% of listeners, this is, 13 years ago, 26% of listeners described themselves as conservative, 23% middle of the road, 37% liberal. A little bit more than a decade later, so 26 conservative to 37 liberal.
Got it.
In 2023, 11% some very or somewhat conservative, 21% middle, 67% said they were liberal.
All right.
We weren't just losing conservatives. We were also losing moderates and traditional liberals, writes Berliner. An open-minded spirit no longer exists within NPR, and now, predictably, we don't have an audience that reflects America. That wouldn't be a problem for an openly polemical news outlet serving a niche audience, but for NPR, which purports to consider all things, ooh, nice turn of a phrase there, all things considered, see what he did. Mm-hmm. It's devastating for both its journalism and its business model. Berliner went on in his conversation with Barry Weiss to say,
do you see NPR and its shift to the left as sort of singular to that organization or of a piece with a much broader trend that's happening inside legacy media institutions?
It's much broader within legacy media organization. I think it's very commonplace. For me, what's different about NPR is we are a public service institution. We have a public mission, and we have a show called All Things Considered. We have a fellowship called the Reflect America Fellowship. So I think we have a particular obligation to reflect America, to understand people from all different outlooks, to bring up things that might be uncomfortable for our progressive audience members, to be a little more daring, to take a little more chance, to be more curious about things that don't fit the narrative. So I think at NPR it was a particular problem because we're a public institution, and for years I think a lot of people felt NPR was like a national trust.
And that trust is broken. And he's absolutely right. He's also right about the descent into a relevancy by becoming a niche outlet for the new Marxists and no one else. I mean, I listened to NPR. They had some very good programming.
I loved Car Talk. That was my favorite show. And then All Things Considered was good, too.
All Things Considered, This American Life, Ira Glass. Locally, I mean, people forget, you'll remember, the NPR political reporter was one of the best, when I came up, was one of the best political reporters in the state. And he was down the middle, Carlos Hernandez Gomez.
Oh, I love Carlos Hernandez Gomez.
Who unfortunately died at a young age from cancer in his 30s. But he was a great reporter. And he was a great, he was a hilarious guy. He did a great John Stroger impersonation. I mean, I really got along well with Carlos Hernandez Gomez, and he was, you know, he was WBEZ's guy, just like Craig Delamore at BBM. He's a throwback to a bygone era.
Yeah.
Same thing down the middle. But I know Craig is left of center, but he's always been fair with me. I think he's generally fair. He's a smart guy and a good interviewer. So there are those people that, you know, would be here, Carlos Hernandez Gomez, if not for cancer. There are people from a bygone era like Craig Delamore, but they represent a bygone era. And that's what I'm not. So it's easy for a conservative to say. It's a little bit more difficult and relevant for Uri Berliner to say it has been at NPR for 25 years. And he goes on to provide some examples that won't come as surprises to us. But again, it's nice to have somebody from inside the castle saying, hey, you serfs out there, you're right. Russian collusion. He talks about, you know, everything that we know. And then the Mueller report. When the Mueller report found no credible evidence of collusion, NPR's coverage was notably sparse. Russiagate quietly faded from our programming. It's one thing to swing and miss on a major story. Unfortunately, it happens. You follow the wrong leads. You get misled by your sources you trusted. You're emotionally invested in a narrative, and bits of circumstantial evidence never add up. It's bad to blow a big story. What's worse is to pretend it never happened. To move on with no mea culpas, no self-reflection. Especially when you expect high standards of transparency from public figures and institutions, but don't practice those standards yourself. That's what shatters trust and engenders cynicism about the media. Russiagate was not NPR's only miscue. And of course, the next obvious one, next election, Hunter Biden's laptop, same deal. And so again, this sort of mea culpa, if you will, or at least a description of the mea culpa that's owed by Berliner, you know, gives him some standing. And maybe if he rose to a more prominent role at NPR, you could change the culture. I mean, there used to be people. I mean, just again, thinking locally at BEZ and the Sun-Times, for that matter, that were fair-minded, that knew where the parameters were when it came to news coverage versus serving as a communications person for your political fellow traveler, my political opponent, generally speaking.
They didn't demonize Republicans.
I mean, I listen Steve Edwards. Steve Edwards, his 848 program on WBEZ was good. I thought it was pretty fair. I was on it a couple times. I was treated fairly. Sun-Times, I mentioned before, you know, Scott Fornick, when he was a political reporter doing, you know, the Illinois political beat. I mean, I know he's left. I know what his voting record is. I know what all their voting records are. We publish them. But again, fair-minded, good reporter, understood the political landscape, didn't just regurgitate the bull jive you're hearing from one side. And so the political IQ of his readers was higher than the political IQ of those who didn't read Fornick or who didn't read or listen to Carlos Hernandez Gomez. Those days are gone in Chicago. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proinsuline, 646-36DA, turnkey.protect. And unlike what Berliner is talking about with Barry Weiss and in this piece, there is no such reflection going on at the NPR Times or WBEZ. There's just the lament, oh, this is terrible. How dare you fire anybody? How dare you not be able to survive despite taxpayer, forced subsidies and How dare this happen? This shouldn't. Oh, my gosh, we're losing an institution, so on and so forth. There's no reflection. There's no contemplation on why it's happening, why you can't make the numbers work. Bob and Waukegan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I'm about as conservative as you can get, and because I listen to you guys during the week and the other station that broadcasts the same conservative people. But on the weekends, when I work in my garage or around the house, I always had NPR on a Saturday. And about 3 years into Trump's administration, they totally switched to completely communist radio, and I couldn't listen to it anymore. I mean, when I did listen to it, my wife would come out, and I'd have my radio on doing work and stuff, and she'd look at me like I was an alien because she couldn't believe I had enough you know, within me to even listen to that for an hour. So it's what the guy's saying is true. Bernie Goldberg wrote a book, 15 years ago about bias at CBS, and Cheryl Atkinson wrote another one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mark Levin's got one out, and I forget the name of the one woman that is a total leftist, and she came to her senses. She was married to a Yazidi Christian for a while, and she wrote a book on bias, and it was truthful. I got it in my bedroom. And then she went off the deep end again and went total leftist and, you know, has said nothing about Kristen Powers.
Oh, yeah, Kristen Powers. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
She wrote the one.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the call, Bob. Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it's one thing for Mark Levin to write a book about media bias. It's another thing for a Sarah Lawrence grad raised by a lesbian who drives a Subaru and has been at NPR for 25 years to say the same thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. Very helpful.
Oh, I'm missing Carlos Hernandez Gomez right now. His wife, Randy Belisamo, member from WPN.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. She started Life Matters Media, which talks about preparing for death. And I think it's a great website. If any of us are ever in that situation, it's good to check it out.
Hernandez Gomez was a good dude. I really enjoyed my time with him.
I loved him, and yeah. I loved his signature hats, and he was just so personable and fair and just an old-school journalist at a young age. You know what I mean? Like, he was an old soul.
For sure. Well, again, this bygone era.
Yeah.
Candace in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Good morning. Yesterday, I was listening to Dan O'Donnell's show up here in Wisconsin. And he said that George Soros, he did a long thing about George Soros buying up conservative radio stations.
Well, his kid.
In Mexico.
Well, what's actually happening is Alex Soros, his kid, who's now in charge, bought Odyssey, which owns stations here. We mentioned this a couple of weeks back, like WBBM News. And what he's actually doing right now, at least, is buying stations like through Odyssey. Stations like WBBM News, so this is a little bit more insidious, right? Mm. So WBBM News is going to not just be the headlines anymore. It's going to be the headlines, but it's going to be headlines that are even more stilted than they are at present, because you use the official news station. All we just do the news. We're not right or left wing talk. We're just down the middle news. And then Alex Soros is going to get in there, and you're going to have program directors that skew things such that the news is just leftist agitprop.
Well, yeah, they want to keep their bosses happy.
Well, but the insurgent attitude here is smart from Soros' perspective. Mm-hmm. And I know he's talked about buying some stations that Cumulus owns too, although, you know, given how far left the local is at WLS, I'm not sure he could make it any more left than it is. There's no question. So, you know, old outlets that some people think are old, not cool anymore because everything's podcast, everything's digital. They still have big audiences, and and there are billionaires like Alex Soros who sees a play to be made there. Maybe that's something that conservatives should take judicial notice of. I completely agree. Thanks for the call, Candace. David in Winnetka.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Right before the BLM landed here in Chicago, I was driving with Uber, and NPR was my absolute favorite I mean, it's the only thing that got me through the day.
And yeah, if you're a cab driver, a driver of any sort, cab driver, limo driver, Uber driver, I think you're required under law to listen to NPR, aren't you?
It's programmed into the...
Yeah.
and you guys, actually, it was a passenger that turned me on to you guys.
Thank you,
so
Mom.
Absolutely. Where was I with that? Oh, so they started running these stories at least one every half hour about a black person that was hung, way back when. And they would say the name and the this and that. I started thinking, I'm like, well, what are they doing here? Why is this? It was just so odd and so strange. And that's, was the start of everything. And boom, here we are. And here's one more thing. I date outside of my race. And
congratulations.
It's Gail.
Yeah.
Did you say you date outside of your race?
It dates outside of his race. He's Irish and he dates Italians.
Oh my God!
No, I'm kidding.
Your mom's
I'm kidding.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, so here's what's funny. I'm dating this gal now. I think. And
does she know you're white?
Does she know you're dating? I mean, you just said I think I'm dating. Are you dating or you're not? It's like you can't be kind of pregnant.
Well, here's one.
Dating from afar.
When these kind of topics come up, like one with the Reed, boy and different things, and you know, you're trying to explain your side of like blacks aren't getting attacked, it's not going on like that, and or whatever, this or that, and she gets so mad and she doesn't want to hear logic. Oh, by the way, she's a high earner. I mean, she makes about 150 grand a year, so there's got to be some intelligence there and this and that. She thinks of slavery that whites went to Africa with guns and we hunted people down and brought them over here and has no clue of how any of it's, and it's saddening. It's saddening because if she thinks that way, man, how many people are getting it wrong? And here we are. And so, anyways, guys, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, David.
I don't think they're going to work out.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
They didn't hunt them down with guns. Okay.
Opposites attract, and she makes 150K. You may want to hang on to her. I don't know. Yeah, we'll see. We'll check back in with David, see how that relationship is going next time we chat. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I want to go back to the Dexter Reed police-involved shooting. We've been talking about it for much of the first part of the show because of the attention it's going to generate. Attention in the form of heat, mainly, not light. We're not really in the generation of light business in Chicago, just heat to feed the racial spoils political system we've set up.
Already making national news.
Of course.
Excessive force, 96 shots.
Right, that's what they'll focus on, 96 shots, 16 shots, hands up, don't shoot. Got to have a handle that mischaracterizes, I can't breathe, that mischaracterizes the situation so as to demonize police. They may not say defund the police anymore, but it doesn't mean they don't want to. And so we know from the body cam videos that were released yesterday that Dexter Reed opened fire first on police officers during this traffic stop. And even after the first hail of bullets, he was able to get to the passenger side of the car. He was outside of the car. You see this from the perspective of one of the responding officers, and you have the next hail of bullets in which he's killed. We also need to remind people that there was a police officer who was shot. He's recovering non-lethal injuries. Also, he was a black police officer, just in terms of the, you just have to include this because you're going to get nothing but racial politics polluting the discussion of this on the merits. And then you have just downright conspiracy theories that are being floated with by the family members of Dexter Reed because they need to absolve him of all responsibility for what he did. Here's his sister's conspiracy theory. Take a listen.
The jump out, whatever they call him, to be 5 deep in the car. If it was a traffic arrest and he was to get arrested, where was he gonna sit?
if it's three in the back and two in the front, where was he going to sit? I don't think that that's what they was trying to do. I don't know, but I just hope that my brother gets justice.
So it was an assassination, then. Is that what you're saying?
No, they were saying that, like, this tactical unit hunted him down.
Yeah, that's
like,
called
they, like, as if they were bored or something. They were hunting him down to.
No, that's called an assassination. What she's suggesting is they assassinated him. They rolled up on him for the purpose of killing him. There was nowhere for him to sit in the car since it was five deep. So they obviously weren't going to arrest him. They were there to kill him. I mean, nobody wants to ask her that question. What are you exactly saying? If you're going to insinuate something, well, just say it straight away. And Dad has a general statement about the police.
And it's been a known fact in Chicago that police always target black and brown communities. People, you know. And as my son got out pleading for help, they shot 96 times?
96.
That's too much. It is about two rounds? Come on, two. I'm watching that. It doesn't matter how your kids feel if they got shot like that, you know.
First of all,
imagine imagine how you'd feel if your kid opened fire on police.
Yeah. Comply. That's one word. Comply. And he was not riddled with 96 shots. 96 shots were fired. How many hit his body, we have yet to know, but it was not some bloodbath.
So how many shots would have been okay? What's the number?
Right. You're right. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
In that specific instance, with five officers responding and then scattering when the suspect opens fire, how many shots was each police officer entitled to fire? Could an expert like Chuck Gowdy or one of the family members or one of the trial lawyers, could somebody tell me, could one of the experts, I don't want to hear from police. I want to hear from the experts. I want to hear from family members. I want to hear from politicians. I want to hear from members of the media. I want to hear from trialers. What's the number? This was excessive. That's what they're saying. Mm-hmm. You just heard Dad say it. You can hear polished up versions of these bottom feeding plaintiff's attorneys say the same thing. So what exactly is the number? And not just in total, but individually, so that we can distribute it. Because then we need to distribute. Now, can we distribute it evenly, or is the black police officer allowed to shoot more because he is a member of a minority group, and the female police officer allowed to shoot more because she is a disadvantaged person too? And then the honky men police officers have fewer shots of the overall total that's distributed in terms of a reasonable response to having someone open fire on you. How about mom?
Why they did that to my son? They didn't have to do him like that. I love my son. He's a good kid. He played basketball. He always had something to do every day. He wake me up in the morning, and he fixed me food. He would show me how to cook his stuff. And he told me, Mama, you eat something and stuff like that. When I didn't feel good, he say exercise. He bought a Peloton bike for me to exercise. And he was a good kid. And why they did him like that, I just don't understand. What is wrong with the police? Why they doing all these kids, pulling them over with for no reason. All these kids, illegal stuff, they don't do nothing all the time. They just be outside trying to find their way. He had just bought his new car 3 days before that. And he was just riding around in his car. He said, Mom, I'm going for a ride. And they killed him. They killed him.
And then she faints.
It's
James Gibson, tortured by John Burge and the Midnight Crew.
You brought that guy up. Okay. I don't know what it's like, and I never want to know what it's like to lose a son, but they killed him. No, he didn't comply. He shot at them. They're just ignoring this obvious fact. And his son just bought his car. That son had side panel damage. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Like that's his new car that he just bought. I don't know.
Maybe it was used. Maybe it was used. I don't know. But yeah, I hear you. And you know, like in these situations, I want to give wide berth to family. You know, you don't want to people are going to grieve differently, yep. and they lost their son, and they want to think the best of their son. And so I'm willing to give wide berth to an extent. And the extent is the sort of conspiracy theorizing and cover stories that they're floating to globalize this so they don't have to localize it. It's police targeting black and brown people. It's a tactical police unit that's actually a death squad.
Right. Hunting that's down what, people.
That's what essentially was asserted. It's right. We don't have agency. My son didn't have agency. Poor baby boy is 26 years old, and it wasn't his first run-in with the law. And you know, it's at some point somebody has to say, look, there is. Did you really think that if Dexter Reed would have complied, keep the window down, let me see your hands. If he would have complied, you think that that Chicago police unit was going to execute him on the street anyway?
Heck no.
Of course, nobody thinks that
no.
because it's not true. But we're supposed to suspend disbelief so that we can indulge this relinquishment of agency. I'm sorry your son is dead, but aren't you sorry that he opened fire on police, that that's the way that he chose to go out? Don't you have a message for other young black and brown men in particular in Chicago and elsewhere to say, you know, let's talk about the talk? And the talk is compliance. And the talk is you never, ever even think about brandishing a weapon, much less attempting to use it against a police officer. It is so basic.
We
can't even get our minds around. We can't even have a conversation. We can't even have leadership in the city say something unequivocally that is as basic as that.
And the head of COPA is questioning whether this group of cops lied about why they pulled him over in the first place. They said they pulled him over for a seatbelt violation. I've been pulled over for a seatbelt violation. You have. We're both white, right?
Regardless of why he was pulled over, and you can investigate whatever you want to investigate. I'm not here to just sort of knee-jerk flack for the cops. Regardless of why he was pulled over, which will come out, there is no scenario in which opening fire on police, forget justified, makes any sense. There is no I fear for my life scenario there. Because you're non-compliant and they draw their guns and say, comply. None. And nobody can say that. Not a politician, certainly not their legal representation, not the family members themselves. It's all these generic tropes about police hunting black and brown people. Give me a break. I'm sorry your son is gone, but give me a break on this. We can't indulge that sort of silliness because it just costs more lives on both sides of the divide of law enforcement, both the law enforcers and those that are suspected of breaking the law. It's a disservice, really. So, again, grieve. Wide berth, but there are limits. There have to be limits. Ken in Grays Lake.
Good morning to you both. I was the police for 35 years. I graduated the Chicago Police Academy way back in 1986. Tactical officer and a firearms instructor. I have no doubt this was a legitimate shoot. I have no doubt it was a justified use of force. And I will give the family a pass on everything because nobody wants to believe their child would do evil. What I do question and what is going to become the focus is 96 shots to eliminate one threat. I question what is going on at the police academy and their firearm program because
Well, did you see the video?
Well, not all those rounds hit him. I mean,
obviously.
I've seen much of the video.
So,
I'm surprised they didn't clip somebody on the sidewalk.
They're around the vehicle, and then he opens fire, and then they, of course, retreat. Right. And they sort of, as best I can make out, they sort of create a semicircle perimeter around the car and around the police car that's parked next to the car. And then you're getting shots fired from, five officers from, five somewhat distinct directions and from a distance, too, because they retreat to what they perceive to be a safe distance behind something to barricade themselves or protect themselves, like the corner of a building or whatever. So, in that scenario, when you've got five responding officers and they're from that distance that you see in that video, and then after the first hail of bullets, he's outside the car. So obviously he was still alive. I mean, you think that's unusual?
I have not seen all the videos. I've seen some of them. I have seen photos of the assailant's car. Kind of looked like the Bonnie and Clyde car, which tells me their shot placement was all over the place.
So clearly. Sure. Yeah.
I'm not even sure if they knew what they were shooting at. And in that case, unless you got a clear line to the target, you contain and you don't open up until you've got eyes on the target. And I just saw bullet holes all over the place. Again, wasn't there, but it's a unique situation when you're being shot at.
Right.
Stuff can go sideways in a hurry. But my only question is, what's going on with the firearms training at EPD these days?
All right. Thanks for the call, Ken. All right. It's a fair question. Al Rosemont.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. This is almost comical. That I feel about this, how the community's responding. I'm sorry for the loss of life and stuff, and I know the mother is grieving, but, to say all that stuff during that process, it was almost foolishness. I think the evidence is clear. There might be a problem over there at the Chicago Training Center trying to press out 1,000 police officers every 3 weeks in efforts to battle crime. I can imagine that being the case.
Thanks for the call, Al. Miro, Northwest Side.
Thank you. Everyone is blaming the Chicago Police Department for the Dexter Reed's death and the sorrow it caused his mother and his family. Dexter Reed should assume the responsibility for the sorrow that he brought his mother and his family. It's his, because of what his actions that he did on purpose, it's because of those actions that his mother is crying, that his family is grieving, and that they're going to have a large funeral bill. Dexter Reed should assume some responsibility for his own actions, not the Chicago Police Department. He opened up fire first, and he did it on purpose. It's Dexter Reed's responsibility, not the Chicago Police Department. They were defending their lives.
Thanks, Merrill. Appreciate it. Rick, Joliet.
Yeah, I'm not really going to dispute two callers ago about shot placement and how many shots were fired, but in the context of renewing a concealed carry permit, the ridiculous rules of engagement, if somebody's in my house or somebody attacks me with a club, I'm not supposed to shoot, I'm supposed to use a club. So maybe the right answer to how many shots should be fired is the same number that the assailant fired, which is two for two, tit for tat, which is a ridiculous argument, almost as ridiculous as this one. To assume that me as a middle-aged white man sitting in a car, open fire on police, would not receive the same retaliation. It's inconceivable on its face.
Totally.
I don't care what color I am if I start shooting.
Totally. Thanks for the call, Rick. We got to run, but totally right. And one reminder on this, too. This is not supposed to be a fair fight, as Rick is pointing out. Police are supposed to bring overwhelming force to a scene so as to be able to de-escalate. This isn't shootout at the OK Corral. This is not high noon.
Combatants.
Exactly. Yeah, mutual combatants.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All right, we have a lot of legal matters to get to with George Perry, so let's do it. George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor. He blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
So we have been talking this morning about this police-involved shooting of a man named Dexter Reed. I know you've seen the videos that were released yesterday, and I know, despite, you know, Philly being the city of brotherly love and all, that there have been cases of excessive force and having to deal with police and having to deal with suspects and so forth, the big city. And so I just wanted to get your take on what you saw. And, of course, you can anticipate, if you hadn't heard, what's coming from the family, their legal representatives, some of the politicians and the media. 96 bullets, 96 shots. This was excessive, even though the suspect shot first.
Yeah. Begin by giving a little background. At one point in my legal career, I ran the unit in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office that investigated and prosecuted illegal use of deadly force by police.
Okay.
So watching these videos was kind of like old home week. And reading about it, and I just started this morning reading about it, it's got all the classic elements. You start off with a non-compliant subject who, if only he had rolled the window down on his car, if only he had gotten out of the car, if only he had followed police instructions, none of this would have happened. And the question becomes, who shot first? And frankly, from everything that I've seen, I haven't been able to determine that, but
It's been conceded that Dexter Reed shot first.
Okay, then that's the ball game, right there. If he started shooting, then the police can return fire, and the number of bullets, however many shots were fired in response, is basically irrelevant. You keep shooting until you have ended the threat. And I saw on the video that once he was down on the ground, Nobody shot him. He was there. They're telling him, don't move, don't move, don't move, and then they cuff him. So everything that I saw was good police work, actually. And in addition to what I saw, what I was reading, and this is just a classic. You've got at least one politician trying to make hay out of the thing by misrepresenting what happened, by claiming to have knowledge of what happened. And, gee, it was just terrible what the police did. We used to get that all the time in Philadelphia. And they'd go to the media and start talking about, here's what happened. And when we would investigate, we would find it was 180 degrees out from what these people were saying. And it appears to be the case in the Chicago shooting. From what I can read here, you've got this one former candidate for mayor, I believe, who is going around saying, oh, yeah, this was terrible. Here are the facts. Here's what the police did. So you always are going to have that element. You're going to have politicians trying to take advantage of the situation to their own benefit. And then you're going to have a family, a grieving family, who then want to sue the city because, depending on what city you're in, like in Philadelphia today, we have a city government structure that routinely concedes these cases.
Yeah, just they're going to get a big check and they know it. Right. But we have the civilian political oversight authority, and, you know, they're part of this, too. It's another, you know, another layer of bureaucracy to enforce a consent decree that's self-imposed and just be another anti-police flack inside the system. And so the they're focusing on the pretext for the stop, and the stop was allegedly for not wearing a seatbelt. And they're suggesting that the officers be stripped of their police power pending investigation because, you know, to use the lawyerly term, because of the pretextual issue of a stop that perhaps shouldn't have been made. Your reaction to that?
My reaction to that is, if it's against the law in Illinois to be driving around without a seatbelt on, then the officers can stop the individual. If they're claiming that, oh no, he was wearing a seatbelt, and they stopped him, I don't know what I'm not sure what the significance of that would be, but I'm assuming that when the police say we stopped him because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, that's perfectly proper. And I watched the video where the female officer, who, by the way, did a very good job, approaches the car and she says, roll the window down. The window comes down and then it starts going back up. And she says, mm-hmm. don't put it back up. The bottom line is this, and this is like 99% of these shootings. All the individual had to do was comply with what the police officer was telling him to do. And if there had been compliance, there would have been no shooting. There would have been no problem. I know he had a warrant out, or he was on pretrial release for a gun charge. There's right. a shock. So all he had to do was comply, and none of this happens. So the police were proper in stopping him. If he didn't have a seatbelt on, they're allowed to stop him, and they're allowed to ask for identification. They're allowed to have him get out of the car if they think he could pose a threat. I noticed that the windows on the car were tinted so that when the window went up, they couldn't tell what was going on inside. So I didn't see that the police did anything wrong here. And the number of shots fired, that's, like I said, you keep shooting until you've ended the threat. So, and of course, with these semi-automatic pistols that are issued, like Glocks and all of that, there has, since the day the police switched from revolvers, six-shot revolvers, to semi-automatic or automatic weapons like Glocks and whatever, the number of shots fired has just gone up exponentially. And that's just a byproduct of the technology involved. I mean, back in the days when all we had were six-shooters, I'm sure there are a lot of people who wish that they had more than just six shots that they could fire. So I just didn't see anything wrong. And all of the video that I looked at and everything that I've read about it, I don't think the cops have done anything wrong, which is not to say they're not going to be in trouble, because there's too many people who have a vested interest in coming down on the police who are going to push that agenda. And, you know, I predict a massive lawsuit and a big payday for the family, and politicians in Chicago turning this into another George Floyd matter and trying to make as much political hay out of it as they can, even if it led to riots or whatever.
Well, we had one person arrested last night, but this morning the superintendent of police, a black man, he wants the four of the five police officers stripped of their police powers, which
Is that pending investigation?
Yeah, pending the investigation, yes. But still, it's like no one's got their back except the FOP.
Yeah. Well, usually what happens is when a police officer is involved in a shooting, they put them on desk duty, indoor duty, until the investigation has been done.
Yeah, that's what's happened.
So that's kind of standard operating procedure. But
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting about this case is the amount of information that's been released. Is frequently the default position of police departments is not to release the evidence and just to stand pat and not mount a public defense, which only leads to more problems. And in those instances that I was involved in where we could get the police department, Frank Rizzo was the mayor back in those days. And Frank didn't believe in sharing anything with the press. But in those instances where we could get the police to release the true facts, it helped a lot to diffuse the situation. And here, I think it's a good thing that these videos have been released and the file is being made public. So that's a good thing. That should help curb some of the undesirable aftermath of this thing. But who knows?
I wanted to get to some other legal matters, speaking of what is right and proper. So this porn star hush money case in Manhattan where jury selection is about to begin. And the judge in the case, Merchant, has denied the motion to recuse himself to recuse himself because of the relationship that his daughter has with all sorts of Trump political opponents, Adam Schiff and others.
Yeah.
A D.C. circuit judge named Reggie Walton went on CNN to defend the judge. So now we have somebody who is ignoring the canons when it comes to even the appearance of conflict of interest. That's Merchant. And we've got Reggie Walton who goes on CNN to violate another one of the canons, which was with respect to cases before the several courts.
Well, it's very disconcerting to have someone making comments about a judge, and it's particularly problematic when those comments are in the form of a threat, especially if they're directed at one's family. I mean, we do these jobs because we're committed to the rule of law and we believe in the rule of law, and the rule of law can only function effectively when we have judges who are prepared to carry out their duties without the threat of potential physical harm.
First of all, Trump made no threat of physical harm in the direction of the judge or his daughter. That's just invented. Secondly, Canon 3A, 6, a judge should not make public comment on the merits of a matter pending or impending in any court. And yet we have D.C. Circuit Court Judge Reggie Walton deciding that it's time to rally around the flag. It's nice to see how these the vanguards of our criminal justice system rally around each other rather than the law and their responsibilities as an officer of the court.
Well, I was stunned when Judge Walton went public and made that statement. I can't recall another time when a federal judge in particular saw fit to go on television or to go public and make statements like that. They're usually very careful about what they say or do in public. And I thought Judge Walton's appearance on CNN, from my standpoint, was unprecedented. And I was basically shocked by it. But look, Trump can say whatever he wants. He hasn't threatened anybody, and he's allowed to say whatever he wants. Now, we have Judge Merchant, who has referred to the case in the District of Columbia against Trump as the federal insurrection matter, even though nobody's been charged with insurrection. So that kind of tells you where Judge Merchant has come from. And on top of that, Judge Merchant has issued the so-called gag order against Trump, which is absolutely and totally unconstitutional. It's unconstitutional prior restraint of free speech. And there is no question whatsoever that that is an illegal order. Of course, Trump being Trump, he says it'd be an honor to go to jail for violating that order. But still, Judge Merchant, if I was Judge Walton, I wouldn't go out of my way to defend what Judge Merchant is doing, but it's all the same club, and they all believe that Trump is a terrible guy, and they're going to go after him. But
I think they
are eroding. Judge Walton is eroding the authority of the court by going public.
Jack Smith, speaking of the so-called insurrection case, you know that's what these impartial officers of the court call it. So I guess we should just fall in line, right? Jack Smith.
Yes.
Jack Smith, the prosecutor, he argues in a pleading before the court that this pending decision on, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but Section 1512 of Sarbanes-Oxley interfering with an official proceeding, which, I mean, Sarbanes, the idea that Sarbanes-Oxley is being used to criminalize a political, I mean, it's just lunacy. Yeah. But I mean, this has the potential, if it is ruled as inapplicable, that you know, hundreds of J6 defendants could go free and be free. Those who have been convicted under this section of Sarbanes-Oxley. Now Jack Smith is saying that even if that the interpretation of that provision of that statute would does not fit, according to a higher court, does not fit the crimes alleged, that the indictment against Trump survives anyway because of the false elector scheme, and the false elector scheme still represents a illegal, criminally improper attempt to obstruct an official proceeding. And so Trump's indictment would survive even if the indictments of other J6 defendants didn't. What do you say?
Yeah,
to that?
Well, the false elector scheme is, let me put it this way, in proposing an alternative slate of electors, which is really what Trump was doing, that is precisely what John F. Kennedy did in Hawaii in the 1960 presidential election. The Republican governor of Hawaii had declared the election in Hawaii for Nixon, and the Kennedy people proposed an alternative slate of electors in order to keep their election challenge going forward so that it would have viability. That's essentially what Trump was doing, not only in Georgia, but elsewhere. And on the day of the riot, they were proposing an alternative slate of electors. It's perfectly proper to do that. John Kennedy, and when he proposed his alternative slate of electors, they did a recount, and then they did a few other things, and finally it came out, okay, we're gonna credit the Democrat electors, and that's what basically swung that, plus payoffs in Chicago, won the election for John Kennedy. So there's historical precedent for this, and there's nothing in the law that says that what the Trump people did was in any way illegal. They were challenging the outcome of the election, and this was just one more way of challenging the outcome of the election. The crazy-eyed Jack Smith is just, you know, he's talking through his hat again, but we'll see where it goes. He's certainly in the right court to be talking through his hat.
Yeah, apparently.
He's before the Supreme Court. Now that he's before the Supreme Court, he may have some problems with that.
One other matter I thought was worth noting, just so it's brought to people's attention when they are chastised about, you know, blind belief in this alleged rule of law, despite the fact that it's being applied differently to different people based on their political dispositions. A federal judge scolding the DOJ on Friday because DOJ refused to allow attorneys involved in the Hunter Biden investigation to comply with subpoenas issued by House Republicans. The judge in the case noting, rightly, that the Justice Department was being a bit hypocritical instructing DOJ lawyers not to comply with committee subpoenas while they have thrown other people in prison, like Peter Navarro, for not complying with congressional committee subpoenas.
Yeah, absolutely true. Absolutely true. And not surprising. I mean, you know, Merrick Garland has been a total disgrace, just a political errand boy for the Biden people. I'm not at all surprised that they've done it, but yeah, that judge is correct. And it is, you know, people talk about the two-tiered system of justice. This is just another example of that.
George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor in Pennsylvania, and he blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, nice being with you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So next round of unconstitutional socialization of student debt, that was announced the other day when Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, was in Wisconsin. Yeah. But, you know, when you want something of a policy nature explained, you obviously go to Kamala Harris.
Of course.
She's the policy wonk in this administration.
Oh, she's the best.
So in case you're confused about the sort of broad parameters of the latest socialization of student debt, who you'll be paying for, Kamala is here at the ready.
Your loans will be completely forgiven, regardless of your income and even if you did not graduate. So I'm going to repeat that. If you've paid undergraduate loans for more than 20 years or graduate loans for more than 25 years, those loans will be completely forgiven regardless of your income and even if you did not graduate. And forgiveness will be automatic for the vast majority of the 25 million people that we believe will benefit from this approach.
And we're just buying more votes.
Charles Payne, one of my favorites on Fox Business. Not my favorite, because that would be Stuart Varney. You know why?
Because he has you on his show.
Exactly right. If Charles Payne had me on his show, I would like them equally.
Oh, my God. Stop it.
So Charles Payne has some room to grow in terms of my affinity. Anyway, Charles Payne, he's been all over this issue. He gets really impassioned about this, which I love. And in reaction to what the Biden-Harris team proposed, this was no exception. Take a listen.
The bulk of it, the biggest chunk, if you go through, at least demographically, 35 to 49-year-olds, mm-hmm. right? We're talking really, like, we know this is a lure for young investors, young voters. You're in college right now. The idea is, hey, I'll never have to pay this back. But people who are paying it back, these suburban families, right? We know this election is going to be won or lost in the suburbs. Mm. This is also a gift to them as well. So, but to your point, about 93% of these loans since Obama have been backed by the federal government. That's American taxpayer money. And, you know, I've gone through the litany of why this is nuts. But think about this for a moment. No income threshold. So you get, you know, listen.
You don't even have to apply for it.
Right.
So, just check the records.
So someone with a master's degree, someone who's going to make $5 million in their lifetime, is going to have someone making less than $1 million in their lifetime paying their college. Yeah. Well, I mean, think how crazy, how unfair is that?
Yeah.
This is the most unfair, most elitist thing I've ever seen over and over and over again.
Yeah.
President Biden, he keeps saying, I'm going to take from the poor and give to the most fortunate people on the planet.
Yeah.
That's a crazy scheme.
I just had a thought, you know.
Crazy scheme. Let's see if Steve Moore can do better than Charles Payne. Steve Moore, economist, Govzilla author. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, guys. And I'm having trouble paying my mortgage, so I was wondering if I could apply for one of these forgiveness things. And also, you know, I have a big credit card debt right now, Dan.
Yeah.
I can't pay it. I was wondering.
That's what's next.
Yeah, Amy, I was wondering if you guys would quote forgive my debt.
And it doesn't matter if you've ever made a credit card payment.
it doesn't matter if you're a millionaire. Yeah. I will pay it off. But if you can't pay off your student loan in 20 years, maybe you went to the wrong college.
It is so maddening. And by the way, they don't even explain why. There's no explanation why someone should have their loan, quote. And don't you love this term, forgiveness? Okay, we're going to forgive you for your loan. Now, I want to mention something. Back when Barack Obama was president, remember Barack Obama? He had this plan that, and we talked about this, by the way, you mentioned that Stuart Varney is your favorite. I mean, I love Stuart Varney, too. I do his show every Monday morning. But what about Larry Kudlow? I mean, come on.
I like Larry Kudlow, but he doesn't have me on as much. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to make that happen.
Yeah,
but anyways,
please.
I was on a show last night, and we were talking about this very issue. And we mentioned the fact that, and one of the guys I was on with, I had forgotten about this, that Barack, do you remember when Barack Obama basically had the federal government take over the whole student loan program because we were going to it was going to be much more efficient that way, right?
Of course.
You know,
like healthcare.
So, and this, you're not going to believe this, folks, but it's true. This was actually, quote, a pay for Obamacare. You know, that we were going to save so much money on student loans,
yeah,
and we'd be able to pay for Obamacare. Now the student loan program is going bankrupt. Nobody's ever. By the way, I mean, again, I get so angry to even talk about this. This is going to be the death of the student loan program. What kind of idiot, what kind of moron would ever pay a student loan from now on?
Well, they won't have to. But, well, obviously, this is a classic way to try and buy votes, but it's not even legal.
Well, and it's important. The point that that Charles Payne makes too, which is a really important one, is you think of these poor 24-year-old, 23, 24-year-olds with this burden debt, and they're trying to make their way. No. He's buying votes. People in their 30s and 40s still paying. You know, that have families in this. And I appreciate having to pay back student loans. I did it too, as Amy did. But I mean, but don't think of this as like the you know, the Gen Zers and stuff. This is, you know, this is getting up to Gen X in terms of buying votes.
Yeah. And it's basically, it is the death of the student loan program, because it's like when we have every 5 years these amnesty programs for illegal immigration. Well, what does that do? It tells people, come into the country, and then 5 years from now you can get amnesty. And you keep doing that over and over again. No one's ever going to pay back a student loan. But another feature of this that I think we've talked about before, but I want to mention, is that first of all, if you don't pay your student loan back, you're a deadbeat. Now, the left has gone completely crazy that I use that term. But what is a deadbeat? A deadbeat is somebody who doesn't pay their obligation. And if you're not paying your – now, look, some people may be in a severe situation where they can't pay their loan. In that case, instead of forgiving their loan, why don't we, you know, refinance it so that they can't pay it? But who is the other villain, Dan and Amy, in this story?
You, by the way, you say deadbeat, I say victim.
Who's
the villain in the story?
Who is the other? Well, I mean, the federal government, the colleges that raise their tuition based on being subsidized by the federal government. There's many villains.
Yeah, exactly. But you're leaving out one. You're right. The federal government is a villain here. The Obama administration was a villain here. Biden obviously is. But the other big villain that nobody's talking about is the damn universities.
Right.
It's the greatest financial scandal in America that we keep subsidizing them. And every time we pay more and more student loans, what do the universities do? What do you think they do, Amy? They raise
tuition. Right. I mean, how is it that when I went to Iowa, it was $7,000 and now it's $40,000?
Exactly.
A year.
This is a dog chasing its tail. And I guarantee you, folks, if this program goes through, it's going to soon university tuition is going to be $100,000 a year.
Well, and the other thing about this, too, is more than two thirds of kids that do go to college are going to state universities that are nonprofits, that are land grant, that have statutorily set tuition. I mean, you're right. I mean, they're all part of the grift is these state universities that are supposed to be accessible. And don't even get me started on their admittance policies in places like the University of Illinois, your alma mater. But I think the larger point here, too, that needs to be driven home again and again is, so Biden is forgiving, but hey, you over the road truck driver, went to apprentice school, didn't go, you're paying.
Yeah.
So he forgives and you get a bill in the mail.
Yeah, no, the working class blue collar workers of America get screwed under this program. And by the way, you mentioned the University of Illinois, and I want to, if I may, just for 1 second, change the topic for a second. But it involves the University of Illinois. I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, that University of Illinois gave their Hero of the Year
Tony
award
Fauci.
To Anthony Fauci.
Yeah.
And have you seen the new report by Rand Paul?
Uh-huh. Yeah. About what he knew?
Those who were... that he knew, he lied to Congress. He is a villain. He should be in jail. And how dare the University of Illinois give him an award? Everything that Anthony Fauci did with respect to to COVID was a lie. He misled people. That guy, I mean, I'm never going to give another penny to the University of Illinois for that. That's outrageous.
Well, I mean, I hate to break it to you, and I hate to say, where have you been all my life, Steve Moore? But the University of Illinois is the same university that hires convicted terrorists like James Kilgore and Bill Ayers, well, Bill Ayers wasn't convicted, but and Bill Ayers at UIC to be on their faculty. So, I mean, Tony Fauci is actually a step up from domestic terrorists, perhaps, arguably.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, folks, do not give your money to that university. I mean, do not. And I, by the way, I have a special place in my heart for Champaign-Urbana. I had a great time there. But that was a different era. It is not the same university it was. And get rid of this damn president of the University of Illinois should be fired immediately.
Back when Steve Moore was there, he was a classmate with Red Grange. And so it was a different time. So, well, we got to tackle this other topic, too, because it turns out that all of the dial turning and lever pulling by the mystics on the Fed have not slayed the inflation beast.
Oh, 3.5%
CPI today, right?
Yeah, 3.5%, and we're on a pace back to 4.5 to 5%. We have not slayed the inflation dragon. Gas. What are you paying now, Amy, for gas there?
Oh, it's creeping up to 5 in the city.
Yep.
4.32 out in the burbs.
Right now, I'm in California. I'm in L.A. Right here, they're paying. I see a sign for my hotel room. Yep, $5.50 a gallon. Boy, inflation's really coming down.
And prices are only going up at the supermarket. I can tell you that.
maybe we need. Well, this is why we need that credit card forgiveness you're talking about. Since you have to use your credit card to finance your groceries and gas purchases. That's going to be the next, maybe that's the October surprise.
That's my point.
You've been saying that for a while, Stephen Moore.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfair that people have to pay a credit card bill. I mean, I think there should be low forgiveness for every debt in America. Let's have it. What do they call that? The Day of Jubilee or something like that, where everyone's debts are just forgiven?
Right. That comes right after the Purge Day, where everybody can just break the law and kill each other. So we've got the calendar is filling up. Steve Moore, he is an economist. He is the author of GovZilla. Thanks as always, Steve. Appreciate it.
What day of the week are you on with Stuart, Barney?
I don't have a set day and time. I'm not a big shot like you. So it's occasional.
Monday morning.
Yeah, I know. Don't bookfoot me, Moore. Yeah, you couldn't get into Northwestern.
Oh my God.
Ouch.
Yeah, see?
Hey, wait, did you apply though to Northwestern?
He did.
That old line from remember the Tom Cruise movie where he doesn't get in Princeton Center. It looks like it's the University of Illinois.
I love that. I love that part of that risky business.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Steve, Mr. Illini. All right.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I love revisiting this Michael Moore riff from 2016. Like a broken clock, Michael Moore is right. He's not right twice a day. He's right once every decade. How about that? I don't know what that compares to. Category unto himself. But Michael Moore understood Trump's appeal in 2016, even if his brethren on the left didn't. And as we have said countless times, the only thing that's changed in the intervening 8 years is the people who play by the rules are getting it harder in the shorts from the political ruling class than they were in 2016, as we were just talking about with Steve Moore in the latest student loan forgiveness gambit. Forgiveness meaning I forgive you and I'm going to force this guy to pay for my forgiveness.
Right.
Michael Moore back in 2016, just to refresh recollections. An instant classic. And this was at a town hall in Michigan.
Every beaten down, nameless, forgotten working stiff who used to be part of what was called the middle class loves Trump. He is the human Molotov cocktail that they've been waiting for. The human hand grenade that they can legally throw into the system that stole their lives from them. And on November 8th, Election Day, although they've lost their jobs, although they've been foreclosed on by the bank, next came the divorce, and now the wife and kids are gone. The car's been repoed. They haven't had a real vacation in years. They're stuck with the shitty Obamacare bronze plan where you can't even get a Percocet. They've essentially lost everything they had, except one thing. The one thing that doesn't cost them a cent and is guaranteed to them by the American Constitution, the right to vote.
Yeah, although...
I just got the chills again.
Although they've certainly tried to take away the right to vote effectively, haven't they?
Oh, yeah.
Between the mail-in election in 2020 and the...
Drop boxes.
Well, all the things that happened in 2020 and then in advance of 2024, allowing 7, 10, 12 million people to come to this country, even as you have movements afoot in urban centers to allow people in this country legally non-citizens to vote in local elections. Gee, what's the mind's eye on that program? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Batya Unger Sargon. She's the opinion editor at Newsweek. She's the author of a new book, Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. It's a story that's just becoming more and more pronounced with each passing day, isn't it? Batya, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I was just remembering the first time you guys had me on for my first book 2 years ago, and I'm so grateful to you for all of the support. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Oh, our pleasure. It certainly did in advance of this book that you penned. As you think about the last 8 years, I mean, what's your characterization of where the American people were in 2016 versus, you know, where they are today, both in terms of, you know, particular segments as well as the divide between those particular segments?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had not heard that Michael Moore quote. I was like shocked. I'm like, He got it. Like he knew this. It's so random. You're right. It's like a broken clock because I hadn't heard that, and it is so accurate. People really feel that things have gotten worse and worse and worse for them. Working class Americans are keenly aware of the fact that in their parents' generation, you could be a trucker or a janitor or a nurse's aide or what have you, and still be able to buy a home, cover all your bills, and retire in dignity, and that American dream has become increasingly out of reach for working class Americans, and it's totally been turbocharged over the last 4 years under President Biden. I mean, people really can't afford groceries at this point. They're standing in the line at the grocery store and putting items back because they can't afford them. What an indictment for the richest country on earth.
Well, we also have this problem of sort of general ignorance, and I suppose this is why the soak the rich line of rhetorical attack continues to work. But there's a poll out about, since we're, you know, on the cusp of tax day here next week. A third of Democrats think the top 1% pay only 1% of total income taxes, as opposed to what they actually pay, which is approaching a majority. It's I think it's at 46%. So they're off by a factor of 46, which is pretty good for Democrats. But still, it speaks to why you keep hearing the same thing we've been hearing our entire life from the left and why they keep saying it. It's working.
And can I tell you something so ironic? First of all, I bet that the third of Democrats who believe that are the over-credentialed college elites. Like, it's probably the most educated who have gone to college who believe that nonsense. But then when it comes to Trump's tax cuts, suddenly all they care about is the total amount that was cut, right? So they don't tell you that the middle class and the working class got the highest percentage of tax cuts under Trump. They only tell you that the rich got all of these tax cuts, right? Because they're complete hypocrites. You're totally right. And the way that the leftist elites look down on the working class and sneer at them and call them racist, and a threat to democracy if they vote for the candidate they think is most likely to help them. I mean, that is the most salient feature of American public life, and it's why I wrote my book, Second Class. I traveled the country interviewing working class Americans from all races, all backgrounds, all religions, all political persuasions. And what I found will not be surprising to your listeners, I'm sure many of whom are working class, it's that there's a lot more unity in the working class than there is division. I mean, polarization is just a totally elite phenomenon because the elites make money and get power off of trying to convince us to hate our fellow Americans.
Well, when you interviewed these people, where did you go to find the second-class citizens of America?
I went all over. I went to California. I went to Ohio. I went to Denver. I spoke to people in Alaska, West Virginia, obviously the whole New York metro area, Houston, Florida. I really traversed the country. I spoke to about 100 people, and then I culled down to the 20 who I felt were both the most charismatic and interesting, but also the most representative. And I profiled them in second class, and then I asked them what policies would help you most. And I spoke to experts, and then I took the experts' policy proposals back to the working class people and said, do you like this idea? Do you like that idea? And came down to the 6 or 7 nonpartisan, totally nonpartisan, easy to implement policy proposals we could do tomorrow as a country that would increase exponentially the number of working class Americans who had access to the American dream.
How many people said student loan forgiveness?
What was surprising
was top priority?
The Democrats and the Republicans were like pretty much in total agreement about what policies would help them. Isn't that surprising?
Well, give us an example.
What's that?
All right. So top of mind, vocational training, which was defunded under President Obama. Really important to people. We have a massive dearth of skilled tradesfolk in this country, and vocational training in high schools, instead of telling everyone who doesn't go to college is a loser, which is like the Democrats' position, because obviously going to college makes you a Democrat, right? So vocational training in schools, getting rid of zoning laws that protect the properties of rich liberals where they don't allow duplexes to be built in their neighborhoods. We could build 1 million homes a year and solve the housing crisis in 10 years if we did that. Other things that were mentioned were getting rid of degree requirements. Immigration was huge. People just want like a total moratorium on immigration, legal and illegal, for the foreseeable future, because they know that it drives down the wages for their jobs. And even, you know, the H-1B visas, why shouldn't Americans be getting those jobs? And then the final thing was health care. They really felt like they couldn't afford good health care. Premiums are insane. Often health care you get through your employment, they have like, you know, deductibles that are $3,000, which is all of their savings go to every year. So I would say those are sort of the majority of the ideas that were. So if you think about it, right, health care and immigration, each party has one piece of the puzzle, but is actively undermining the other piece of it. And it's really, as far as I'm concerned, the first party that gets to that combination is going to have a permanent majority. So, you know, if the Republican, any Republicans are listening and want, you know, a policy platform, you know, most working class people, they don't like welfare, but they also support, you know, rich people paying more taxes. They are very pro-gay, but very worried about trans. You know, they're sort of somewhere in, they're extreme moderates is how I would characterize them.
Where did they come down in terms of the rank order priority of coverage for gender reassignment surgery? Was that a big issue to the working class?
I was so surprised that people were so supportive of the gay people in their lives, including a lot of Christians who I spoke to who had a gay person in their life who they wanted treated with respect, but they were very, very against trans people in sports, trans people in bathrooms, and teachers talking about sex to children. They thought all of that was terrible. I spoke to a gay CNA in Florida who told me that any parent who takes their child to a drag show should be put in prison.
So interesting. So, I mean, yeah. So on the cultural front, I mean, right. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of always been the disposition, even when there's disagreement, but we're not able to disagree anymore. We have to sort of, you know, demonize and intern and so forth our political enemies. But it's sort of what you're describing is sort of a live and let live philosophy. Like, I mean, you as an adult, you can chart your own course. So, but, you know, you're rights end at the tip of my nose, and don't compel me to pay for your choices and the consequences that come from your choices, and don't make me and everybody else have to sort of reorder our entire lives to accommodate your choices and the consequences of your choices. Is that sort of a fair summary?
It's 100% accurate, and the best example of this, I think, was Most of the women I spoke to, whether they were Democrats or Republicans, told me that they would never, ever get an abortion because it's against their beliefs. But they also were against an abortion ban because they felt that it was not their right to judge their neighbor and her decisions. That is who the American working class is, conservative and deeply tolerant.
Do they generally agree with me that angry white leftist females in the suburbs who went to went to exclusive colleges and whose husband makes six or seven figures are the worst people in the world and we need to do something about them?
That particular set of concerns didn't come up, Dan.
All right. Maybe it's the way you framed it. Maybe I'll tag along next time and plumb the depths of that. Yeah. But part of that is what you're getting. I'm obviously sensationalizing it, but what you do get to in your book in a substantive way is, people that don't live in wealthy enclaves in the leafy suburbs or metropolitan areas, they're a little tired of being patronized and talked down to. Is that something?
Oh, my God. The contempt that the elites have for them, you know, on cable news and the liberal media, the contempt, they feel it keenly, and they've started to return the favor. They really are very aware of the fact that, you know, the people in the knowledge industry created an economy that was an upward transfer of wealth from the middle class. I mean, it was a plunder of the middle class by the leftist elites. And now, instead of acknowledging it, they sneer at the people whose futures they stole. I mean, that is 100%. Working class people are very keenly aware of that and feel resentful about it, although they're all still remain to this day deeply patriotic people. They really believe in this country, and we should really believe in them.
Are you going to stay in touch with the people that you interviewed for your book?
Yeah, of course. I've been going back and forth with them, you know, as the book progressed, and sending them a copy and finding out what they think about it. It's been really, really rewarding and deeply, deeply humbling that they shared their stories with me. I'm forever grateful. A few of them came to my book party. It was really nice.
The book is Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. The author is Bhatia Ungar Sargon. She's the opinion editor at Newsweek. Again, the book Second Class. Bhatia, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. God bless you guys.
Thanks. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Do we have Why Dan Prop the single? Spur
we
of the
do.
Moment, I know.
Justin, cue the music. Or maybe not. Why Dan Prop the single? I believe
why,
it goes
why don't you
Dan.
Sing
a
few bars.
For another reason why Dan Prop the single.
Oh, I don't know music. I was hoping. I've got some songs I want to add into the rotation for that little segment. We'll update it. But anyway. Oh, there it is.
Oh, yeah. Vin, this song is so cheesy.
Well, the Spando Ballet thing, I've told you before.
What do you have, Dan?
You know, Spandau was a prison in Germany where Nazis were held. And the Spandau Ballet refers to the hanging of Nazi war criminals and then, you know, them sort of dancing as they hung from the gallows.
What's so romantic, Dan?
Well, that's Spandau Ballet, the band name. That's right. What it's based on.
Okay.
You know, the song, but anyway, I digress. But that is actually not inconsistent with dating. This happened on a commercial flight. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
This woman gets on the plane and she asks if she can make an announcement. And the stewardess, that's what they're called?
They're called flight attendants, Dan.
Yeah, so the stewardess said, sure. And here was her announcement.
Please join me.
Let's clap for the crazy lady.
Hey. Hi, guys. I'm Carolina Geets. I'm looking for a rich husband. My seat is 2A. Please join me if you're rich. Hmm. And that generated applause, I guess, for the...
Maybe they just wanted her to sit down.
Yeah, I hope this doesn't spawn more of that. She was very happy that the airplane staff were supportive of her idea. They're very supportive of gold digging. I guess she's some sort of influencer, who isn't, on TikTok. She's got 628,000 TikTok followers. Apparently none of them are rich men who want to take the plunge with... Miss Geets, and she is still looking for a rich husband in case anybody is mad at their money and they would like to date Carolina Geets, much less propose. Said that trying this out takes a hell of that's what the commentator was just applauding her. She has not gotten an offer yet, but what did she say about this? She said, although I haven't found my future husband, the experience gave me a huge boost of confidence and motivation. Good. I like when gold diggers are encouraged. She also said that she could do like the dating apps, but, quote, I prefer meeting people in person as I feel it leads to more genuine connections. Sure, genuine connection over someone's net worth. I won't deny that a rich husband is something I desire. It's not because I'm materialistic or shallow. Of course not.
No.
That's why you're
She's
leading
doing
with
this
it.
For love, yeah.
I know what I want, and I'm unapologetic about pursuing it. There's a woman who knows what she wants. Mm-hmm. If you've got a couple shekels to rub together, I would just encourage you to steer clear of Miss Geets.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This outfit called Sound Investigations, investigating corruption in adult industries and more. Adult industries that, of course, these days, and corruption, these days necessarily implicate federal law enforcement or spy agencies like the CIA and the FBI. And so they did one of these guerrilla interviews, undercover interviews, mm-hmm. like James O'Keefe made famous. The last repository of real journalism, perhaps, or at least investigative journalism. In addition to a few like Paul Sperry and Cheryl Atkinson, a few others. It was like what O'Keefe does a lot too. I think this was like a gay dating app setup. I'm just guessing from the interaction between the undercover journalist and this guy, Gavin O'Blenis, who's a contracting officer with the CIA and formerly was at the Bureau, FBI, one of the, you know, guys in the surveillance trucks. So he says. The question that was put to him, there among several, was the issue of entrapment. If you want to get a pro-lifer, if you want to get some other enemy of the state, you know, like, say, a conservative Catholic who attends a Latin Mass, how do you do it and stay on the right side of the entrapment line?
You can kind of put anyone in jail if you know what to do.
How?
You set them up. You create the situation to where they have no choice but to act on their impulse. And once they act on that impulse, then we call that entrapment. It's a fine line.
Does the Bureau practice entrapment a lot?
We get really close.
Not officially?
No. We get as close as we can. We get as close as we can to it without doing it.
So they can entrap some of these pro-lifers into doing things that they
depending,
don't...
Yeah. We call it a nudge.
A nudge. Mm.
Sometimes you just gotta give them a quick little... just to see what happens, right?
And how does that happen?
You put a post out there, or you have someone fake profile say something that triggers... that we know is gonna trigger them, right? Like, we already know your history. If we're to that point, we already know everything about it. So we're like, oh, this will piss them off. sometimes you light the fuse and just wait for it to follow, right?
Like a railing. Mm-hmm. Like a, oh. So when a railing happens, sometimes the bureau behind it?
Yeah, sometimes.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Setting up a rally or posting some sort of false profile or false comment on social media to try and nudge your target into doing something they might otherwise not do. The nudge. I've heard that phrase before. I was trying to place it when I was watching this video. I think John Cass's brother, Nicholas Cass, used the same term. And he was a Foreign Service officer. He was CIA, retired now. But I think that's the phrase that he used, too, in terms of how these some of these deep state actors conduct business. The nudge. Not entrapment. It's a nudge. Redefining entrapment to being a nudge. Now, again, we've talked about this in the context of sort of the Eva Perón of East Lansing, the Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping plot. And, you know, no matter how much someone nudged me, I'm not going to participate in a kidnapping plot for a public official or anybody else. However, that doesn't mean that this is a right and proper use of limited law enforcement resources. And, you know, thinking about, too, just the thought process that goes into deciding who your targets are going to be. Is this rank order priority in terms of threats to public safety, national security, or is it based on, I don't like that guy's politics, let's see if we can take him out? Because the way Oblenis talks about it, it sounds highly political, particularly when he refers, as he did, to Trump in this interview, well, again, undercover interview, date, I think, as Cheeto, mm-hmm. And he characterizes Trump as having incited a riot. Incitement. Didn't use the word insurrection, but he did use incitement, something else he hasn't been charged with. Anyway, he goes on to explain targeting. And you always want the biggest and the loudest. His words. And one such case study that the journalist and the CIA contractor go over is Alex Jones. And as you know, I'm no fan of Alex Jones. I think he's, generally speaking, a goof. I think it was reckless and defamatory what he said about Sandy Hook, and he paid the price for it.
Yep, he sure did.
So I don't give Alex Jones any quarter. But to live in a free society is to defend the rights of people you find objectionable. Because defending the rights of people you don't find objectionable is easy. But that's not how it's supposed to work. And when you target somebody like Alex Jones, as we find out from Mr. Oblenis, former FBI, now a CIA contractor, who interfaces with other agencies with whom the CIA contracts for specific things, including armed services, so he says. And there's a LinkedIn profile that the investigator posted to credentialize this guy, so we know he's not completely making up who he is, even if maybe, we don't know, but maybe he's embellishing. But this riff on Alex Jones and that whole Sandy Hook business and the defamation suit is troubling. See if you can pick out the troubling spots.
You always want the biggest and loudest. Like that, what was his name? The one that said Sandy Hook didn't happen.
Alex Jones.
Yeah, so we were after him.
You are? Are you still after him? Why?
Because he's broke. He got found guilty and had to pay like $100 million.
So what? Why were you after him?
We're not anymore.
Just to get the money from him?
Yeah.
Was that court case used? Was that a CIA?
Sure was.
That was an agency thing?
Well, actually it was a defamation case. Mm. So it's a civil, not government. But we were looking at all of his followers, commenting, following, like, who's that going to be this time, right? So even though it's technically not our, well, not the agency, definitely, but the Bureau, for instance, yeah, it's not our purview. It's a civil matter. But since they got all this access to his stuff, and it's there, what can we go find?
So two things there. One, he explained that, you know, they couldn't bring this matter because Alex Jones didn't violate the law.
No, it's a civil matter. Right.
Right. But we say, look, to the Sandy Hook families, this is I'm characterizing what he said. We can't do anything because he didn't violate the law. But, you know, we can suggest that we think there's a strong defamation case that you could pursue in a civil court, civil action you could pursue against Alex Jones. So we don't instruct, we just educate is the phraseology he used. But the other piece of it that's troubling to me is we use that opportunity to follow his followers, to track Alex Jones fans, and to see what else we can come up with.
Right, that's just creepy.
Right. Oof. Right. So I'm not an Alex Jones fan, but I'm also not a fan of the CIA, or in this case, the FBI. I think he was with the Bureau, as he calls it at the time, just indiscriminately picking out fans of somebody, whether I like them or not like them, and deciding, let's see if we can turn over some stones and take a look at what crawls out. Because that's in the interest of national security. Well, I mean, I guess if you start from the premise that, America firsters, white Christian nationalists, are the greatest threat to our democracy, as you hear the left say all the time. You say, well, Alex Jones fits the bill, and therefore his listeners or social media followers fit the bill. So let's take a look at all of them. That's a pretty broad foundation to start pouring through for agencies that have the kind of power the FBI has to start pouring through people's lives, isn't it? You cannot like Alex Jones and be deeply troubled by what you just heard. In fact, you should be. One more. January 6th. Mr. O'Blenis provides some detail that we can't get out of FBI Director Christopher Wray.
No.
So, I thought you said that there were FBI agents in the crowd at J6.
There always are when there's a big protest in D.C. Just in case it gets out of hand like that.
But there wasn't
enough to turn that tide. I mean, I'm talking they maybe have 20. You needed 1,000 to get rid of that crowd.
So they had just 20?
Yeah, just to go through and observe and see what they can hear, you know, that kind of thing.
Wow. Definitely. They needed 1,000 at least.
Wow. Well, that's also Capitol Police jurisdiction. They're in charge.
So the FBI,
why they didn't have more on hand, I don't know.
The Bureau didn't really want people knowing that they were in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
That would be overstepping their bounds.
A little bit.
Do people know that?
Why?
Did people know that the Bureau was in the crowd?
Nope, and probably never will.
You know agents that were there?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. So what's the agency now?
Do you know agents that were there? Yeah, I know them because they work for the agency now. They work for the CIA where he's a contractor.
Got a text message. Dan and Amy, anyone who's surprised by this hasn't been paying attention.
It's not about being surprised. It's about documenting it, and it's about taking statements like this guy makes and turning over some stones at the CIA and FBI, isn't it? Because that's exactly what members of Congress should do. I would do if I was a member of Congress. So there's the belief about what's happening, the dot connecting that is logical, and then there's the evidence that you can take action with. And that's what's relevant here. You know, all this, like, I'm not surprised, and so move on. No, you take information, points of concession, like you just heard, that we can't get out of the FBI, no matter how many times Wray appears before congressional committees. Now, somebody said it, and he's credentialed. He may be mid-level at the Bureau. He may have been mid-level at the Bureau, and he's a contract employee with the CIA. He may not be at the top of the food chain here. Doesn't sound like he is. Maybe, as I said before, he's embellishing. I don't know. Maybe he's trying to impress his date, and he's saying things that he thinks is true, but he couldn't prove either. Although when you say, like, I know some of the people that were in Jan 6 that are now at the agency, that's very specific. So that requires now a follow-up conversation that is not undercover, like to be subpoenaed before a congressional committee and take whatever he asserts under oath and put that to Christopher Wray, for example, doesn't it? So that's why it's not just something to say, oh, I knew that was happening. Yeah, well, good for you. Now let's do something about it. Isn't that what the point is?
It's just creepy. His former FBI agent, he's boasting that he can put anyone in jail, just set him up. We call it a nudge.
Yeah. Oof. Right. There's a lot in a short 7-minute video you should find deeply disturbing, even if you suspected it was happening. The point is to help remove scales from others' eyes and ears as it pertains to this business. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. It's Andre Vizhninsky or Levin Beria.
Levin Beria. Yeah, Levrente Beria. Yeah.
Thank you for the pronunciation. So give me the man and I'll give you the case against him.
Right.
You can find anybody. If you go into anybody's past or present and you provoke them and put them under pressure, almost anybody, they're going to do something wrong. So it's not so much to get a case against or get them in jail. The process is the punishment. Just the fact that what Trump is going under right now, that's punishment enough, but it's actually flipping against them. But that's their mentality.
Right. You mean sort of like a SEAL Team 6 raid on that pro-life prayer warrior in rural Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Traumatizing his children. You know, when all they had to do is do a phone call and I'll meet you at your attorney's office.
Right.
But they don't do that.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Jordan in Antioch.
Good morning, Dan. My name is, hey, I don't mean to plug anybody else, but there's another host, Bongino, that does a really good explanation of the flush. And you brought up Christopher Wray, how they use this, and guys like this guy in this interview will concoct a narrative and pass it to the media. The media will report on it, and then it goes to Wray, and now an investigation starts. And he does a really good job explaining how they did that with the Russia crap, with Trump and Jan 6. And the other thing, like you pointed out, was that nudge. And I listened to that podcast with you and John Cass's brother, and that was awesome. That guy is just amazing.
Yeah, he's super sharp.
Nudge.
Nick Cass, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and that nudge, right? That's how they got the guys in Michigan, and that's how they're getting people on Jan 6, and that's how they can get a lot of other people in this justice system is you don't have to be a part of it. You just have to be a part of a conversation that they can document. And then that gets used against you and turned into an investigation. And in this justice system, you're guilty if you're part of a conversation, whether you agree or otherwise. And that's the scary part, is that's where we're at. Nothing is taken in full context. It's only snippets. And then you're guilty in the public eye, and then they get you guilty in the court of law. It's scary where we're at right now. It's really scary. And I hope a lot of people are paying attention to that comment that you made, the nudge. Thanks, guys. Have a good week.
Thanks, Jordan. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.